Chapter 4. The Onion Routers. Jacob Applebaum drops a black, hard plastic container the size of a small suitcase on the conference table in a sterile, chic conference room in MIT's Media Lab, a six-story structure of sleek white walls and glass that resembles a giant iPod. 20 or so motley hackers sitting around the table and lounging in the corners of the room suddenly look up from their laptops. Applebaum cracks the box open to show off a large chunk of white, ruggedized hardware encased in foam. The group admires it in hushed tones, slowly drawing closer. The 27-year-old stands in the center of the room, 6 feet tall, with neatly parted black hair, Italian glasses, and tattoos that run up his left arm. His t-shirt is a baseball jersey with the word Kinsey written across the back and the number 3. The reference to his position on the Kinsey Institute's sexual persuasion scale. 0 indicates heterosexual, 6 homosexual. "This," he says, chewing a piece of raspberry chocolate with studied nonchalance, "is what I've been working on." Until that moment in the Tor Hackfest, things had been getting dangerously technical. Tor is one of the world's most widely used and perhaps most secure anonymity programs. And Nick Mathewson, Tor's grinning, round-faced, ponytailed chief architect and co-director, had kicked off the day by dropping the room into the deep end of the cryptographic swimming pool. The geekery had gotten so thick that even some of Tor's modern-day cypherpunks and volunteer coders, loath as they might have been to admit it, might just have gotten lost. Within minutes, Mathewson, wearing a sport jacket over a Tor t-shirt over a dwarfish potbelly, was delving into security issues like epistemic attacks and Byzantine fault tolerances. By the time he sat down, still grinning, a growing fraction of the room seemed baffled or possibly bored. Applebaum's presence, on the other hand, is as much gorilla as geek. He's Tor's field researcher, unofficial revolutionary, and man on the ground in countries from Qatar to Brazil. And he knows the appeal of a sexy piece of hardware. After instantly acquiring the room's attention, Applebaum explains that the device his small audience is ogling is a satellite modem, one that he's just rented with the aim of figuring out how to make Tor accessible to those in the Middle East who need to use satellite connections to access the Internet. The project is not theoretical. For the prior 3 weeks, an entire civilization has been turning itself upside down. The wave of revolts that overthrew the government of Tunisia and ousted President Hosni Mubarak from Egypt has just spilled into massive protests in Morocco, Libya, and Bahrain. And while the rest of the world has been lauding the power of Twitter and Facebook to organize and catalyze those movements, the digerati in this room know that the protesters' connection to the Internet has a more sinister side. Unless they use anonymity tools like Tor, every dissident who plugs into those online services can have his or her information perpetually monitored by governments that don't hesitate to knock down doors and haul away political enemies on a whim. Hence, Applebaum's latest science experiment. He aims to shield the identities of dissidents and journalists who use satellite connections to get online even when the government has locked down, throttled, and surveilled their bandwidth. But there's a problem, Applebaum says. Tor hides a user's IP address, but a satellite modem's communication protocols reveal its location to the satellite provider. Even if you use Tor, someone can still find all the users in a given country, Applebaum cautions. That means you need to connect to the network and then drive 50 kilometers, or you get the cruise missile. If you need GPS spoofing, my people in Zurich can help with that, offers one clean-cut researcher with expertise in hacking pacemakers and cardiac defibrillators. Okay, Applebaum says in an unimpressed tone that implies spoofing GPS is about as difficult as microwaving a burrito. A gaggle of hackers pepper him with questions about the modem specs and the company he rented it from. I gave them your information, Mike, he says, turning to another Tor programmer with a mock sheepish smile. Sorry. No one needs to ask why Applebaum wouldn't hand out his own personal data. Even among Tor's security-conscious crowd, Applebaum is an exemplar of privacy paranoia in its purest form, and lately for good reason. Because aside from his day job as a programmer and evangelist for Tor, Applebaum moonlights as a freelance internet freedom fighter, one that many governments, including America's, might like to see disappear. Just the night before the MIT gathering, for instance, the young hacker was probing the digital infrastructure of Libya, where the military was busy firing live ammunition at defenseless crowds that included women and children. Muammar Gaddafi's dictatorship had shut down most of the internet, leaving only its military and government connections online. So Applebaum used a tool he created called BlockFinder to list which branches of the country's networks remained online and broadcast their IP addresses to any and all hacker allies. Systems that are online in Libya are probably worth scanning. Those are the systems required or used by the current government oppressors, he wrote on Twitter. He suggested digging into one connection in Palermo, Italy, that connected North Africa with the internet at large, what he identified as the Arab dictator's favorite uplink. Now is the time for all good black hats to come to the aid of humanity, he added, throwing in a riff off a line from the film Full Metal Jacket. I wanted to visit exotic Libya. I wanted to meet interesting and stimulating people of an ancient culture and own them. Black hats, of course, are hackers who engage in usually illegal tactics of intrusive or destructive hacking. And to own a target is hacker jargon for penetrating or taking control of its systems. As in a message Applebaum had posted just a few hours earlier, shooting unarmed protesters in the head, Bahrain's government has demonstrated that they are over the line. It's ethical to own them. During the protests in Egypt a few weeks earlier, Applebaum had put out another call for help in tracking down President Hosni Mubarak to prevent him from fleeing the country in the middle of the revolutions there. I'm looking for Mubarak and his handler's cell phone numbers. If you've got them, I'll track them, he wrote. Mubarak is trying really hard to not end up like Nicolae Ceausescu, he added, referencing the Romanian dictator who was executed by a firing squad after a two-hour trial during the country's 1989 revolution. Good luck with that, you son of a bitch. Applebaum later explains to me that a technique known as an HLR query can approximate a user's location on a carrier's network. Did he ever successfully use that trick to pin down Mubarak's location? The young hacker smiles and changes the subject. But organizing penetrations of Libyan internet infrastructure and tracking dictator cell phones, as legally questionable as those feats may be, aren't the most pressing reason for the young hacktivist's privacy obsession. Applebaum has ties to WikiLeaks, not simply as a nameless volunteer, but as one of its most diehard supporters and its most prominent American face. In late 2010, Julian Assange told Rolling Stone that Tor's importance to WikiLeaks cannot be understated, and that Jake has been a tireless promoter behind the scenes of our cause. In late 2010, when Assange seemed to be on the brink of long-term jail awaiting questioning for alleged sex crimes, one WikiLeaks staffer told me he hoped Applebaum might even be the favored successor to Assange in WikiLeaks' hierarchy, none of which is news to the U.S. government. Several months earlier, Twitter revealed that the company had been directed by the Department of Justice to hand over Applebaum's data, along with that of two others associated with Julian Assange's secret spilling group, likely part of a larger dragnet to build a conspiracy charge against WikiLeaks staffers. Since then, the threat of an indictment that could put Applebaum in prison for a significant portion of the rest of his life has been hanging just a few inches above his neck. Even here at the MIT Hackfest, that threat makes its presence felt rather awkwardly when, as Applebaum tells it, he runs into a State Department official later in the day, a clean-shaven man dressed in a gray fleece. Applebaum greets him politely. You probably want to shoot me in the head, he says with a wary grin. We have other people who do that, the official says, also smiling. Neither of them seems quite sure whether this is a joke. At least twice now in the evolution of leaking. It was the U.S. government, specifically the U.S. military, and even more specifically the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, that built the machine that would ultimately hemorrhage the government's secrets. DARPA, after all, created the prototype for the Internet, that massive secret-siphoning neural network. And along with the State Department and the Naval Research Laboratory, DARPA would also build and fund Tor, the tool that WikiLeaks would use to effect the largest ever public data breaches against the military and the State Department, exactly the institutions that created it. Stranger yet is that even after Tor was allegedly used by Bradley Manning and potentially many others to anonymously leak massive troves of highly secret U.S. government documents, government agencies haven't withdrawn their support for the tool any more than they've withdrawn from the Internet. Because just as government agents can't survive without the Internet's information-sharing powers, they also sometimes need the ability to be completely anonymous online. Not simply private, but strongly, cryptographically anonymous. Tor offers that cryptographic anonymity to its users with the same principles as David Chaum's Mix network, but stripped down and built to function at web speed. Like a mix, the software doesn't necessarily prevent anyone from seeing what a web user is writing or reading. Instead, it's designed to prevent anyone from knowing who is doing the writing or the reading. That's because if a CIA informant in Iran is visiting the agency's website to drop a tip, the government spying on the informant's connection doesn't need to know what information he's passing on. Even if the data he shares is encrypted, just the knowledge that he was talking to American spooks is likely to earn him a knock on the door from the country's secret police. The State Department funds Tor to communicate with political dissidents from Iran to Myanmar and to help them access the unfettered web, a key element in Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's mission of so-called Internet freedom. The U.S. military uses Tor for open-source intelligence, gleaning foreign policy or military strategy from other countries' websites without tipping them off to a spook's presence. Corporations use Tor to facilitate industrial espionage, or in some cases, prevent it. One example offered by Tor's executive director, Andrew Luman: IBM hosts a copy of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office database. If someone at Hewlett-Packard wants to browse sensor designs in that database without tipping off its biggest competitor, it had better use a thick cloak of anonymity. But Tor can also work in reverse. A website implementing a Tor feature called a hidden service can mask its location and allow users to find it in the web's ether without anyone knowing where the site is physically hosted. To access a Tor hidden service, the user has to run Tor too, so both the visitor's physical location and that of the site are completely masked. Neither reveals anything other than the information they're sharing, like two trench-coated men handing off a briefcase in a dark parking structure. And like any setting where packages are exchanged in the shadows, crime has found its way in too. It's no secret that Tor is used by child pornographers and black hat hackers. Seconds after installing the program, a user can untraceably access sites like Silk Road, an online bazaar for hard drugs and weapons, or one of several sites that claim to offer untraceable contract killings. But Tor is also used by the FBI to infiltrate those lawbreakers' ranks without being detected, and for cybersecurity researchers to test websites without tipping them off that they're being patrolled by McAfee or Symantec. When I'm speaking to a law enforcement crowd and someone complains that Tor is used for crime, I find an agent who uses Tor every day for fighting crime. Then I try to get those two to talk to each other, says Tor's director Roger Dingledine. Technically, Tor faces the same tricky paradox Chaum aimed to solve in 1981. Location equals identity. If someone can locate your computer, they know where you live or work, which is a trivial step from knowing who you are. So Tor needs to accomplish the Internet's main task, mapping out connections between people so that data can travel to and fro as quickly as possible, without letting anyone in the system know where those two ends lie. Like its users, Tor operates in a state of functional paranoia. It assumes that its network of messengers is littered with traitorous spies, and no single node can be trusted. So taking a cue from Chom's original mix idea, the data is triple encrypted. No one node can figure out the entire route. Each node unscrambles one of those three layers, as if each of the series of messengers removes one opaque skin from an onion to find the address of their next contact written on the surface underneath. Hence, Tor's name, an abbreviation for the Onion Router. Since Tor employs the uniquely targeted scrambling of public key encryption, each layer of onion skin is wrapped in a way that can be unwrapped only by the next node. All the messengers have keys to a layer of the onion, but they can only open the layers specifically addressed to them. So that first node in the chain might see that an Iranian informant wants to visit a website, but it can only open the layer of encryption that tells it to pass the rest of the onion on to a node in Cupertino. Even if Iran's secret police control that relay, they'll never know that the data jumped from California on to Berlin and finally to the CIA website in Langley, Virginia. But is Tor secure enough to stymie the CIA itself, along with its brainier cousin, the NSA? The typical answer to that question is one I hear from Chris Segoyan, a Soros Foundation fellow who lives in Washington, D.C., and spends his days fighting for stronger privacy and anonymity regulations. Have you got a better alternative? Tor, as Segoyan and most other security researchers will tell you, is not secure. For those who have watched the world of cryptography long enough, nothing is. Every crypto system has hidden weaknesses that another clever cryptographer will ferret out, and almost any scheme can be cracked with enough time and computing power. But Tor has been torn apart and banged on for years, says Segoyan. Every year, flaws are found and fixed. Because of that, it's better than the rest. It's the only solidly peer-reviewed anonymity system for real-time communications. In fact, Tor has been shown to be vulnerable to a slew of brilliant attacks, most found by Tor staffers themselves. One, for instance, involves a website feeding the user a sequence of data that can be recognized coming out the other side of the network to match up a user with his online activities. Another uses flaws in common file-sharing programs to reveal the IP addresses of the program's users and then extrapolate the addresses of others. A third depends on the temperature of the servers. Hotter computers run faster, and an attacker can start to recognize and analyze Tor hidden services based on fingerprinting those timing differences. Whether those attacks could be performed at scale to identify a leaker remains an open question. If anyone could perform massive cryptographic and signals intelligence feats on large networks, it would be the NSA. For now, there's no known real-world case of Tor being broken to identify a user. All signs still indicate, for instance, that it was Adrian Lamo, not the NSA, that ultimately fingered Bradley Manning. The Tor user federal agencies would have liked to have identified more than practically any other. Even many of those who are most skeptical of Tor's security suggest that users seeking absolute anonymity should still use the tool, along with other commercial proxy services, to create extra layers of defense. But it can't be denied that Tor has a fundamental flaw, and one that is also its greatest strength. Any agency or individual can set up a Tor node on a computer. By subtly starting up hundreds or thousands of nodes around the world, the U.S. government might be able to get access to a large enough fraction of the comings and goings of Tor users to map out their communications and find their endpoints. To do so, of course, would mean ingeniously disguising the nodes and competing with every other government that seeks to track the network, many of whom might not be keen on sharing their intelligence. In fact, Tor's community-built properties are fundamental to its functioning. They were, in some ways, the seed that germinated from an idea deep inside the military's institutional mind into the public Tor project as it exists today. And if Onion Routing's inventors hadn't needed to share the technology beyond the walls of the Pentagon to make that volunteer system work, It might never have become a software Frankenstein's monster, directing mayhem directly back at the agencies that created it. When Paul Siversen, the researcher known by many today as the father of onion routing, arrived at the Naval Research Laboratory in 1989, most of his degrees were in philosophical logic, not mathematics or computer science. As an undergraduate, bumping up for the first time against ideas from epistemic logic, a field that seeks to rigorously answer formalized questions about what can be known, he pored over the puzzle books of Raymond Smullyan, the eccentric writer, pianist, and magic performer. Smullyan once dazzled the audience on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show with questions like this one. Say you have three opaque containers of coins, one full of nickels, one of dimes, one of both types of coin mixed together. All three have been mislabeled with one of the other's names. How many coins do you have to pull at random from each jar to properly rearrange the labels? The surprise answer? Just one coin from the container labeled mixed. Late-night television audiences were clearly more entertained by epistemic logic puzzles in 1982 than they would be today. Smullyan would later sit on Siversen's dissertation committee at the University of Indiana, and often wandered into the young graduate student's office to pull cards out of Siversen's ears or rehearse logical scenarios with a younger researcher. Smullyan's books permutated ever more complex versions of a type captured by a well-known riddle, the one about asking directions from two men, one who always tells the truth and one who always lies. His increasingly tangled conundrums were populated by vampires who always lie, humans who always tell the truth, insane humans who think they're telling the truth but lie, insane vampires who think they lie but actually tell the truth, and some in-between actors whose truth-telling is utterly unpredictable. So it's fitting that when Siversen approached the problem in 1995 of how to route the web's information anonymously, his solution would depend on tolerating many thousands of untrustworthy characters. Siversen, with fellow NRL researchers David Goldschlag and Michael Reed, was determined to build a mixed network for the web. But they faced the same challenge that inspired Lance Cottrell's Mixmaster email anonymity program. Clever spies can correlate messages going in and going out of a network based on timing. The bad guy watches 3 bytes go in and 3 bytes come out, says Siversen. When the data is moving in real time, it's an analysis that's easy to perform and hard to defeat. Lance Cottrell had solved that problem in Mixmaster by designing the program to collect individual messages for hours or even days, the better to obscure their timing. On the web, where users hardly tolerate a second's delay, that approach would fall flat. So the researchers suggested a less than elegant fix. A network so big, with data going into and coming out of thousands of nodes, that matching up the head and tail of every connection in real time becomes a matter of finding two ends of a needle in a haystack full of bits of needles. If your adversary is in a position to watch both ends of the communication, he wins, says Siversen. But if the adversary can't see those ends, he doesn't even know where to start looking. And the most practical way to expand the network? Invite everyone to join it. The NRL team imagined a volunteer network run by a diverse crowd of hosts, each controlling its own piece of the mix of relay nodes. In that populist system, no user can trust every node, but every user can be relatively sure that no single host, not even the system's creator, the Navy, is watching the entire network and tracing users' paths. Today, Tor has more than 3,000 nodes, each receiving and sending off data packets in unpredictable paths, and Tor's organizers hope to someday broaden the network of relays to tens or even hundreds of thousands more. To work, that volunteer mix didn't just need to be big. It needed to be diverse. Lots of unlikely bedfellows hosting nodes, everyone from the U.S. intelligence agencies to cypherpunks, attract a motley network of users. And without a diverse set of users, an anonymity network is hardly anonymous. If only the Navy used Tor, It wouldn't take much Smolyanian logic to figure that anyone using Tor would be part of the Navy. For Tor to offer meaningful anonymity, the military had to set it free, to be both maintained and used by everyone from hackers to revolutionaries to criminals to G-men. In that sense, even though Tor was first created behind government walls, there could never be the sort of debate over the public distribution of the strong anonymity tool that took place over the public access to strong encryption in the 1990s. Even if the government had sensed that the software it was funding for masking users' identities was a dangerous weapon, it couldn't keep that program to itself. To be effective, Tor had to be shared with everyone, even those who would use it against the very institutions that created it. The Naval Research Lab's idea of recruiting a volunteer network wasn't Tor's cleverest trick, just a formalization of what Mix networks had already been doing since the early cypherpunk days. But to work at web speed, Tor also needed a new, faster way to route data at web velocity through its three-stop circuit. Chom's original idea used public key encryption to scramble the data it sent from one node to the next, a process that took as much as 1,000 times too long for real-time traffic. So the NRL team suggested a shortcut. Old-fashioned symmetric key encryption, where the same key is used to encrypt and decrypt data on both ends, is far faster than the public key encryption invented by MIT's cryptographers in 1977. But symmetric key encryption is less secure, in that the keys have to travel to their destination and might be eavesdropped. If, however, those symmetric keys are themselves encrypted with public key encryption and only decrypted once they reach the nodes in the network, they can be securely set in place, well guarded, and ready to decrypt data far faster than public key encryption keys. In Syverson's system, each node would use slow, secure, public key encryption to generate public keys for encrypting and private keys for decrypting. Then the user's software would triple encrypt the first parcel of data with the public keys of three randomly selected nodes in far-flung places around the globe, just like any Mix network. But the first message sent along that triple bounce path wouldn't be any real communication from the user. It would simply hold three more keys of the old-fashioned symmetric key encryption sort. Only once those new, speedy private keys were placed safely in the three nodes around the globe, laying out a path to their destination, would the user start sending packets of real content bundled in three layers of symmetric key encryption that the relays could peel off, one after another, at blinding web speed. In fact, Tor today repeats that entire preparatory process every 10 minutes, repeatedly laying down new paths with public key encryption to offer one more safeguard against surveillance. Syverson coined the term onion routing because the first data package to travel across the network was less like a triple-wrapped rock with a hard center of information than an onion with nothing but layers all the way down. It would be a carefully wrapped envelope with no message inside. The crucial data held by that envelope, like the sweetness of a Georgia Vidalia, was in the skin itself. Even with the Navy's innovations, Tor was still just an idea. But it bounced around Syverson's brains for years, like so many triple encrypted data packets, well after Goldschlag and Reed had moved on to other research topics. So when Syverson received a grant from DARPA to revive the project in 2001, he needed help. The father of onion routing, despite his logical prowess, had never quite learned to code. Syverson had met Roger Dingledine a year before at the Privacy Enhancing Technologies Conference in Berkeley, where the recent MIT graduate was presenting his own digital freedom-focused brainchild, a project Dingledine called Free Haven. Dingledine, a ponytailed and apple-cheeked savant with strangely unblinking eyes and a robotically logical manner of speaking, explained that Free Haven would function as a distributed, uncensorable publishing system. He pointed to examples like the property records that had been destroyed in the Kosovo refugee crisis in the late 90s. Kosovars, displaced by Serbian attacks, returned to their land to find that no one had any formal proof of who owned what. Someone didn't want those records around, says Dingledine. If Freehaven had existed, there might have been an archive of that data, and it wouldn't have been vulnerable to political, social, or corporate pressure. Dingledine's project, outlined in his master's thesis at MIT, depended on distributing information among many anonymous volunteer publishers and constantly grading how reliably each node served up data. To Siverson, it sounded like a project near to Tor's heart. By the time Siverson found Dingledine, the young hacker had joined a Cambridge startup called Reputation.com and was using ideas analogous to his Freehaven reliability system to grade the reputation of suppliers in business-to-business commerce. The system presaged the reputation network used by eBay to rate buyers and sellers and offered plenty of intellectual challenge. But it lacked the political drive of Dingledine's anti-censorship work. So when Siverson asked Dingledine to help him implement a real-world tool for creating total anonymity, Dingledine was ready to jump. Siverson was soon using DARPA's money to contract work from the younger researcher and then convince him to leave Reputation.com outright. It wasn't long before Dingledine's role at Tor started to exert a gravitational pull on his closest college friend and co-worker at Reputation.com, Nick Mathewson. A few years earlier, Mathewson and Dingledine had immediately bonded as freshmen at MIT. Mathewson had grown up watching and rewatching Tron on VHS, fiddling with PGP, and reading the cypherpunk mailing list archives. Dingledine, raised in North Carolina, had found early dial-up access to the internet through the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's VAX system and created an architecture for networked, text-based dungeon worlds where users could meet, talk, and embark on fantastical quests. The two teenage hackers moved into MIT's Senior House, a dormitory with a legendarily bizarre culture, captured best by its official emblem, a star-spangled banner-emblazoned skull with the words, "Only life can kill you," in its teeth, and the motto, "Sport death," written below. That two-word phrase, once found written in pen in the MIT library copy of Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 72, denoted an attitude of pushing life to its limits, whether in politics, recreation, or hacking. Sport death culture mixed MIT nerdery into a stew of anarchism, leather jackets, drugs, and polyamorous sex. Music blared at all hours, boxes of computer components often littered the hallways, and sleep was generally considered an occasional nuisance. Mathewson painted the larger two walls of his room bright red, and the other two black. His theory was that the red wall's psychosomatic effect would keep him alert and reduce his sleep requirements, with the black ones offering enough contrast to shock his brain into hyperactivity again every time he returned his gaze to the red. Mathewson and Dingledine spent much of their college lives in their rooms, hacking away at a half dozen computers, each kept running constantly. Dingledine named his flock of PCs and servers after Lord of the Rings characters, while Mathewson named his after Personae from the songs of Frank Zappa. "Most of the interesting things I did in college, I did in software," says Mathewson. Mathewson and Dingledine subscribed to Sport Death's anti-authoritarian politics, and they lived by the mantra embodied by Tim May and Eric Hughes, "Cypherpunks write code." Don't spend your time arguing with politicians in the physical world about the rules of the digital one. Create the digital world, and with it, your own rules. "Network protocols are the unacknowledged legislators of cyberspace," says Mathewson. "We believed that if we were going to change the world, it would be through code." So when Reputation.com suddenly found itself sinking into the quicksand of the dot-com bust, Mathewson was ready to join his comrade in digital progressivism at Tor. Funded by the Navy and DARPA for the next 3 years, Dingledine and Mathewson took apart the tangled code base developed by the NRL and rebuilt it from scratch. By 2004, there were still only about 100 nodes on the nascent Tor network, mostly researchers who were curious about the project. Mathewson and Dingledine, perhaps still living in an MIT-like bubble where everyone was an adept hacker, We're distributing Tor as raw source code, tough to use for non-geeks. The Civil Liberties Group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, on the other hand, saw Tor's potential for mass adoption. They injected another round of funding for Tor to create Windows, Mac, and Linux versions that anyone could install. And Tor's network quickly mushroomed out to several hundred more relays. But it was only in 2006 that Tor's value suddenly left the realm of computer science theory and jumped onto the world stage. That year, Dingledon and Mathewson started to get emails from users in countries like Iran and China, regimes that filter their internet and monitor it to spy on opposition groups. Tor, unbeknownst to the hackers who created it, had accidentally become one of the world's most effective censorship circumvention tools. By encrypting traffic and routing it indirectly to and from websites via foreign nodes, Tor stymied the digital filters in countries that weed out sites with anti-government messages and pornography. And unlike other services that promise to skirt censorship, programs like Freegate, UltraSurf, Hotspot Shield, and Siphon, it doesn't merely give users access to verboten content while potentially allowing the regime to track their online activity. Tor offers a portal to the web that's both censorship and surveillance-free. The Broadcasting Board of Governors, a little-known U.S. government agency responsible for U.S.-run media outlets like Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia, and the Persian language Radio Farda, contacted Dingledon and asked whether he'd be interested in financial backing to make Tor sleeker and more usable for its censor-skirting audience. The State Department followed up with its own infusion of cash. The result was enough funds to pay the project's entire small staff and develop a new incarnation of Tor known as the Browser Bundle, a program that can be installed with more or less two clicks. Tor incorporated as a nonprofit. Since then, both its numbers of nodes and users have exploded. The service added 36 million users in 2010 alone. But Tor's tens of millions of new friends came with powerful enemies. In a gesture to the transparency of its inner workings, Tor publishes the IP address of every relay in its network. To prevent a government from simply blocking all those addresses, it maintains some semi-public relays that it calls bridges, publishing them on chat networks and social media sites. In 2009, China began crawling the entire Chinese language web looking for Tor node addresses and blocked nearly all of them. Since then, Tor has been playing a game of cat and mouse with the authorities who seek to strangle it. And it's often winning by only a move or two. That's not enough to satisfy Dingledon. "We need to take big steps if we're going to stay ahead," he says grimly. "We need to win this arms race for a while." Tor has two aces up its sleeve. One is a plan to build a Tor home Wi-Fi router. The Wi-Fi hotspots, in theory, would sell for less than $100 each and run Tor by default, automatically pushing all the users' traffic through the anonymity network. In exchange, it would function as a Tor bridge relay. Tor's staff hopes those little boxes might add as many as 10,000 nodes, vastly strengthening its network. Its other secret weapon is a small army of globe-trotting developers. One of them is Jacob Applebaum. Since Applebaum joined the nonprofit as a staffer in 2008, the young anarchist has served as one of Tor's primary coders, as well as one of its international evangelists, preaching the gospel of anonymity wherever he goes. In a one-month span just before we met in Boston, for instance, Applebaum had traveled to Brazil, China, Turkey, Poland, Germany, and England, as well as several U.S. cities, giving talks, rallying like-minded hackers to run Tor nodes and volunteer for the organization, and distributing copies of Tor and bridge relay addresses. If the users or developers he meets worry that Tor's government funding compromises its ideals, there's no one better than Applebaum to show the group doesn't take orders from the feds. He refers to capitalism as a system of violence And in spite of Tor's early Navy funding, he speaks disdainfully of those who work with the military as war profiteers. In his role as an auto-mythologizing hacktivist, Applebaum looks the part. His hair has taken the form, variously, of sculpted black spikes, a shaggy side mop, or a bleached blonde crop. His face is studded with piercings that periodically migrate, and tattoos have staked out a growing portion of his body. The largest, on his upper left arm, is a symbol of a peacock taken from the symbology of a group of Satan-worshipping animists he met while traveling in war-torn Iraq. Several of his personal stories of radicalization, including a few from that trip, were fittingly unverifiable. But Applebaum's best evidence of Tor's purity from Big Brother's interference, perhaps, is his very public association with WikiLeaks, the American government's least favorite website. In a surprise speech at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference in July 2010, Applebaum gave a keynote address on behalf of WikiLeaks after Julian Assange decided that traveling to the United States spelled legal trouble. Since then, the U.S. government has expressed its displeasure with him by tasking Customs and Border Protection agents with harassing him every time he crosses the border, where the Fourth Amendment's restrictions on searches and seizures abandon citizens. According to Applebaum's accounts, he's often detained for hours, searched in intrusive bodily detail, and forced to miss any connecting flight. In those detainment sessions, Applebaum is separated from any phones, computers, or storage devices that he may be carrying, a painful security breach for a privacy-conscious cypherpunk. After abandoning several computers that he considered compromised, he no longer travels with a hard drive in his machines. "How does that work?" I ask. "Not very well," he says. He takes the harassment with a dose of humor, often live-blogging his run-ins with customs on Twitter and at least once leaving a spring-loaded snake inside a fake can of nuts for a customs agent to find. But the intimidation as he tries to re-enter his own country serves as a constant reminder to Applebaum of the looming threat of prosecution. When the agents interrogate him, he says the questions are always the same. What's your relationship to Julian Assange? What's your association with WikiLeaks? Applebaum usually responds to those questions with stony silence, and he won't answer them from me either. But when I ask Applebaum if Tor is in fact the powerful tool for anonymous whistleblowing that Assange and others believe it to be, he smiles. Then he quotes Assange, quoting Oscar Wilde. "Give a man a mask," he says, "and he'll tell you the truth."